which is Dogen's instructions for Zazen. And he also has another, even more abbreviated Zazen instruction called Zazengi. And I thought I'd just to start out this afternoon, I thought I'd just read it. The Dogen says, to practice Zen is to sit in Zazen. That's it. To practice Zen is to sit in Zazen. For sitting in Zazen, a quiet place is good. Prepare a thick sitting mat. Do not allow wind or smoke to enter. Do not allow rain or dew to leak in. Set aside an area that can contain the body. There are traces of those in the past who sat on a diamond seat, that's the seat, the Buddha seat, or sat on a bed of rock. They all were seated on a thick carpet of grass. I think he means tatami.
Tatami.
Yeah. We have, what's this called again? Goza?
Goza.
The sitting place should be bright. It should not be dark, day or night. To be warm in winter and cool in summer is the way. Cast aside all involvements and cease the 10,000 things. Good is not considered. Bad is not considered. It is beyond mind, will, or consciousness, and beyond mindfulness, thought, or reflection. Do not try to become a Buddha. Get free from sitting and lying down. Take food and drink in moderation. Guard time closely. Love sitting in Zazen as if putting out a fire on your head. The fifth patriarch at Obaizan Mountain had no other practices. He solely practiced Zazen. When sitting in Zazen, wear the kashya, that's the okesa, and use a round cushion. The cushion does not support the whole of the crossed legs. It supports the backside. Thus the underside of the folded legs is on the mat, and the bases of the backbone are on the cushion. This is the method of sitting used by the Buddhas and patriarchs when they sat in Zazen. Either sit in a half lotus posture or sit in a full lotus posture. To sit in the full lotus posture, put the right foot on the left thigh, and put the left foot on the right thigh. The toes of each foot should be symmetrically aligned with the thighs, not out of proportion. To sit in a half lotus posture, just put the left foot on the right thigh. Let the robe and gown hang loosely and make them neat. Place the right hand on the left foot, then place the left hand on the right hand. He's talking about the heels, yeah. With the tips of the thumbs resting against each other. Keep the hands like this. Draw them toward the body. Let the tips of the thumbs meet in line with the navel. Sit erect, letting the body be right. Do not lean to the left, incline to the right, or incline to the right, or slump forward or arch backward. It is essential that ears are aligned with the shoulder and the nose is aligned with the navel. Let the tongue spread against the roof of the mouth. Let the breath pass through the nose. Let the lips and the teeth each come together, and let the eyes be open. The eyes should neither be wide open nor half closed. Having regulated the body mind like this, let there be one complete exhalation, sitting in balance in the mountain still state. Think of the concrete state of non-thinking. Of not thinking. How can the state of not thinking be thought? It is non-thinking. This is the real secret of Zazen. Sitting in Zazen is not learning Zazen meditation. It is the great peaceful and joyful gate of Dharma. It is the untainted practice and experience. This is from the Shobogen. Well, this morning we we started our examination of sitting meditation, kind of approaching it as if we ourselves were the teacher, the transmitter of light. So, is there any follow through or anything from this morning that came up for anyone? Where shall we continue? Where were we? I think you can't go wrong.
Can't.
But as far as Soto Shu formal etiquette, how it's done, I don't know if there's a space missing. I would imagine it would be as you say, Yubao. Again, if we were giving meditation instruction to someone, we talked about how to sit down and how to align the body, and we talked about the mudra. What the mudra is. Did we cover everything about the posture?
Sometimes you talk about how the posture is kind of tells you where you are. It's sleepy or holding on to something tightly. I don't know if you did you touch on that?
No. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I just remember in the past you talking about it and saying that how it kind of guides you in your practice, so your body will tell you, you know, if you're sleepy or dozing off, or maybe you're hanging onto something with intensity, that this is what I remember, I think, but that it kind of to pay attention and observe is kind of like that.
The mudra too. It said the mudra can kind of be your guide if you're experiencing tension in your body. Oftentimes people will push their thumbs together.
Or like this.
Or they're too excited in a certain way, like mentally excited, have too many exciting thoughts. Or physical tension, then the mudra might be like that. But if you're kind of spaced out or dreamy or sleepy, then usually your mudra kind of collapses that way. So your mudra is kind of like a little barometer about how you practice. In case you don't know, you know.
And the best is just very lightly touching.
Very lightly touching,
yeah,
like a feather touch, as if they're not sure. They want to meet, but they're not too sure.
I can't do it much now because I have a T injury. But I always show people to sit like this, like as a knife's edge here.
A knife's edge?
Like this is a sword, you know, coming down. And you sit on the edge part rather than sitting back here.
On the top.
Because it will, when I first started sitting, I noticed that I used to sit all the way back on it like this.
On the top of the cushion.
On the top of the cushion. Okay. And this leg would go to sleep within maybe 15, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I found that when I got off of that big, you know, artery on both sides, and just came down more on the cushion and then put more weight up on my knees and sat a little more forward, my legs wouldn't fall asleep. But then, of course, there was more pressure on my knees.
What I do sometimes is I take a support cushion and put it on the back of the cushion.
So yeah,
the cushion is actually angled in. Yeah.
And then the other thing that I do is this. I roll that in. Sometimes if that knee, I don't know if that's allowed, but sometimes that what's allowed?
Yeah, the Zen police are...
Zen police. Love jerk. Yeah, sometimes I cheat and put that, roll that up.
But I do feel like another thing you've said before that's really I've experienced is a good posture that's kind of hard to break out of. So after you sat for a while, it's kind of it feels very comfortable when you're in it and settled in it. And the more pressure I can disperse through the knees and through the back, feels really nice when you're in it. And when you're in practice, I'm not really focused on it, but kind of like you had mentioned before, when you move, this a while ago, but when you move out of that posture, it's kind of like, you know, a little bit of a struggle to move out of it. Because you're so settled into it.
Like a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're in a boat. You have to step out of a boat. Yeah. He's a boat. He's a practice boat.
Practice boat.
Yeah. That's your Dharma name. Boat. Boat. Practice boat. Right?
Practice boat?
Boat. Oh. Boat.
Boat. Oh, boat. I'm boat. Sorry. Couldn't hear that clearly.
Boat.
Yeah, I think there's, for me, there's also something about posture that's more than the sum of its parts.
Okay, say more about that.
There's maybe you could call it a gestalt. There's this Buddha form that sometimes if I've actually not terribly comfortable, I can bring the whole form of Buddha sitting. I just like move into the form, the whole form of this beautiful posture. It has a wholeness to it, as well as the knees do this and the back does this, and the shoulders do this, and the head does this.
Mm-hmm.
There's also
the whole thing.
That there's what can't be taught, and it can only be felt. So sometimes I can just kind of let go of all of the details and just feel Buddha. Just coming into my whole body as one package.
Hmm.
One package. Hmm. And I just kind of settle into that. And everything relaxes.
And you're no longer thinking about the technique or method or process.
I'm not disparaging any of all of that. But I think it's more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
The one who sits.
Mm-hmm.
The one who sits. I was in a session once and couldn't sit because I was in too much pain and realized that something was sitting. Something was sitting and wasn't moving. Mm-hmm. I was having all kinds of trouble, but I was absolutely perfectly still.
Zazen was doing Zazen.
Yes. Yeah. Is that what that is? And that was quite a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the same kind of thing as you. Buddha for you.
The other focus of meditation that's common to our tradition is attention to breath. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that. What is this? It's called Anapanasati. Awareness of the inhalation and the exhalation, awareness of the flow or the breath. So, does anyone have any, as far as us transmitting, teaching, this way, what would we say about that? Or not say?
I taught myself, before I came here, I taught myself this practice of just saying in the whole time. My breath was coming in and then out the whole time. It was coming out. And that was how I learned how to meditate before I came here.
You had an internal...
Yeah. It was just in and out. In, out. And not forced. The breath not forced the natural rhythm, but having that internal in and out. And then eventually that drops off and there's no more internal sound. It's kind of like rocking a baby for a while.
And it's asleep.
Yes. That's mine. And when your thoughts come, just bring your attention back to your breath. Just like they go, and you just come back to in.
In the Vipassana tradition, some of the Vipassana traditions, Theravada traditions, there's a real strict attention to the actual physical sensation of breath.
Mm. So
the actual sense of the slight change of air temperature as the air comes into your nostrils. That's one thing. Or the column of air that's moving in and out through your torso, or the abdomen, the expansion and contraction. Would you, as teachers of the way, would you recommend, would anyone recommend that or advise that?
I think, you know, I went into the sutra and actually memorized the 17 points of breathing in. I'm aware that I'm breathing in, breathing out, I'm aware, and so on. And then
there were 17 points?
Yeah. There's four lines of four lines each, plus an introductory line.
So the Satipatthana?
Yeah.
The Satipatthana.
Uh-huh. And then that leads to the four foundations of mindfulness and the seven levels of awakening and the final clear knowing and liberation, the ideal and object of letting go and letting go of illusion, etc. Hmm. And it's very simple to teach, and it's very simple to actually. So I go through it in the mornings quite frequently, and you know, it just takes a minute or two in starting to sit. It's quite useful, I think.
One thing I've noticed is it's you have all these different people coming from different backgrounds, and everyone has such a who's been a practitioner in any capacity seems to have a really unique flavor or way of doing things around the breath. That, and they like to do it that way. That's why, like earlier, how you said that you can't really destroy this. You can't do it wrong. And
oh, you can do it wrong.
Well, I mean, my point. You can't. People are going to come into the practice kind of with a way of doing things, and it's a skill to be able to suggest something and allow them to still feel supported. Because if you don't communicate that properly, then they don't feel like they're supported in how they're showing up and who they are. But I do believe. I mean, obviously, it's very important. Like what you said, Thich Nhat Hanh does that too. I'm aware of breathing in, I'm aware of breathing out, I'm aware of my body's tension, I'm releasing that tension now. And those are all really wonderful practices, and and important for settling into your body, and into that moment, and into that space, and using it to come home. I feel like I ran into people that want to do counting, and they, I can't tell you how many different ways.
The early Buddhists, I mentioned this before, the early Buddhists had, the early Sangha had something called a kathantanas. A kathantanas, it's a Pali word that basically means topics or subjects of attention. And the attention to breath is just one of those 40 topics. Actually, the number of topics are infinite. They're based, they're circumstantial. So there'd be a preceptor, a guide, and then there'd be the novitiate. And the novitiate would, the preceptor would see that this novitiate was, say, kind of flighty, for example, kind of dreamy and flighty, and his feet were just not on the ground, and it was just had all, was too idealistic or something like that. So this, the preceptor of this student would give this student a specific kathantana, a topic. And one of the topics were called kasinas. Again, kasina means just kind of a general field. So kasinas could be a color. And they would, the person would just, instead of working on the breath, instead of working on the posture the way we do, they would look at a, they would gaze at a color. They would set up a field in front of them, and they would look at a certain color. And but say this person was too dreamy and too flighty, and they needed to get grounded. One of the main kasinas was called the Earth Kasina, and people would clear a area on the earth, and then they would just gaze at that, and they would develop a kind of, you might call it a kind of intimacy with the phenomena of solidity of earth, of a place. And that would be a kind of, what would you call it? That'd be an appropriate topic for someone who was imbalanced and needed to come down onto the ground. And there were other kathantanas. You probably heard of some where people want to be aware of the actual impermanence, the fleeting nature of existence, that this existence is just for this time and just for this place, even though we carry around an idea of permanence and we make all kinds of presumptions based on the permanence of things. And even though we know that things aren't permanent, still we carry around these ideas. So someone who was very needed to really focus on that, the preceptor would give him, send him out into the, what do they call it, charnel grounds, where people had died, and apparently in India at that time, death wasn't hidden the way it is in our culture. You know, they don't send them to the funeral home and they disappeared somehow. Death was, you could go and see death. It was much more readily available. And so they would go to these places where death was visible, where decomposition was visible, and they would really get it, you know. So there were all these topics, that very interesting, that they were much more, what would you call it, much more expansive, I guess you'd say, or selective, or they were individually attuned. The topics of attention, but one of them was the breath, and the breath became, this breath became synonymous with body awareness, and it became pretty much the universal or the most common topic of kathantanas. There were many, many different ones.
Yeah.
The Brahma Viharas, have you heard of those? The Brahma Viharas, the Apramanas. The Brahma Viharas are these like loving kindness. We have this Metta Sutta. Metta is one of them. Mudita is another one. Karuna, compassion. So these would be topics that applied topics. And this was applied meditation. So that's the other side. You know. And the Zen side, there's less sort of directed application to meditation. It's more just... Just what's happening. Just.
Do you run into the super fast go 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 kind of people, and they're all, well, I want to count. I count, and even if you try and hold space for the simplicity and beauty of just the breath in and out. I'm aware of breathing in, I'm aware of breathing out. There's just this tremendous... Maybe it's L.A. But they're just like, you know, I want to count. And
they want to count their breath?
Yeah.
They want an assignment.
Yeah, right? They do.
Yeah.
But they're not doing something in their head. Mm-hmm. And they're not achieving anything. So, what do you do for the counter?
The stick.
Send him out on his ear?
The beauty about breathing is it can really slow down a lot. Your whole physiological process is slowed down. If you get them to that state when they have 2 breaths a minute, give them the target, they'll be relaxed.
So... And that's and definitely with these people got them to that relaxed state in practice, but they still seem like they want to gravitate back towards doing, back towards counting. And I ran into this, and it's the same group of people, and where, you know, yeah, I like counting, and when I get to the 6th breath, that seems to be my breath, is the 6th breath. And for me, I kind of want to just give them space to do that. I don't change and mix it up. I do kind of like what Karen said. I keep it very simple, very basic.
Coben said that counting your breath in practice is like knitting. Yeah, knitting. It's busy work.
It is.
Be careful.
Yeah,
I wouldn't recommend it to anyone, because you're just replacing one discursive sort of pattern with another.
So I try and explain, you know, I can't. Come as you are. I want to support him too. It's kind of like you said, there wasn't a lot of instruction when you first started. There wasn't for me either. It's like, there's the wall, go and sit at it. And I think giving them the space to bring that in is important too.
When I'm picking blackberries, I just seem to naturally start counting. 1, 2. Or, you know, stepping on cracks. I don't regard that as necessarily a kind of busy work. Mm. There's something very natural, can be very natural about just. It's almost like marking the breath. And when it gets to be really tedious, I think people will give it up. I know I did naturally, very naturally, you know. But there can be something, I think, quite wonderful and beautiful about but not this, getting attached to making it to 10, I don't know, I find it, how many blackberries did I pick in the bucket, you know, how many Hmm. Oh, no, it's just, it's okay. It's what people do, and I'm sure all of us have gone through different phases of, in our practice where we did the counting, and then only, I know I just counted to one for a long time.
Yeah.
And then I let go of that, and so it's, you know, wherever people happen to be.
And I guess I'm just feeling for, and I think this is a really important thing, is the most appropriate bridge, the most appropriate way to honor that person and hold space for that person while they're trying, while they're doing all that, you know, and knowing how to speak to it. And, you know, and I do, I foundationally keep it very simple, and I don't, part of my practice is to stay grounded and not start, you know, doing all these different things and whatever. I mean, I would never naturally do that. But I was just wondering if there was a quick fix other than maybe a bamboo stick to the forehead. With some of these people.
One of my most well-loved podcasts and then teaching, when I was teaching people meditation, was as soon as the group got there, I said, tonight we're not going to meditate. Don't try anything at all. Forget about it. Throw it out the window. We're just going to sit here. You're not meditating. And then suddenly, after a while, everybody was just so still and quiet. And afterwards, they were like, I had the most remarkably deep and calm meditation. My mind just calmed down, and I was focused on my breathing, and then I just let that go. And I was just sitting and just listening, and then I let that go. And I'm like, see? Drop the meditating person.
That's true.
You do right, yeah. Meditator.
Yeah.
Because I play the drums, and when you first learn how to play the drum kit, there's this really awkward stage that everyone goes through where they're really very stiff. They're like the kind of the monkey that plays the drums, and you go through that because you're getting the muscle memory, you're learning how to count, and you're learning how to do something different with every limb and kind of split your mind into listening to different parts of the band. And where you come in. And there's this stiffness that goes on, and you're really thinking about it and struggling with it. And then one day, you have forgotten, and you're playing the drums with no drum.
And Allen Ginsberg had finished a three-year... No, it wasn't that long for him. That's the original thing. But he did a long retreat. It was like over 3 months. He hadn't seen anyone for a long time, and he came and heard Coben talk.
Really?
And he said, I've got a... Coben, I've had a pain. I've been practicing for these various weeks, and I've got a pain in my back that won't go away. And Coben said to just breathe with that, bring your breath to that pain, and breathe into that pain. What I've been focusing on lately is we face a wall most of the time, of kind of aligning my back with that wall, kind of making my back kind of noble and like and upright like the wall, and then making my the whole front of my torso with the strength of my back, which includes the back of my head, with that strength or that stability, the whole front of me, the front of my torso, and particularly my face. My yoga teacher has taught me how much tension we carry around in our face, because she's often stop gripping in your jaw and relax your ears. I can't imagine someone, you know, but she's trying to get us to let go of that. Well, something I'm working on now is kind of making the front of my torso and my face soft and open, and almost like it's kind of melting or swooning. And I feel like I can do that with confidence because my back's stable. my back's sort of a wall. So I can just let the whole front of me hang out, so to speak. And then my breath, when that happens, my breath becomes, it doesn't become this kind of narrow phenomena of just a column of air coming in. It becomes like, it becomes really spacious. And also, I've pretty much given up the sense of following my breath. That to me is like a tyranny. It's an assignment. It's a project. I don't want to go there. I tried for a while, and I failed utterly to fulfill it as a project. For me, it's enough to just really appreciate and enjoy one breath, mm-hmm. one inhalation and one exhalation, and then wait until the next breath comes. And maybe if I feel like it, if I'm inclined, I will, because I appreciate that previous breath, I may hang around for the next breath. But that's where I am in my kind of breath awareness. It's like breath by breath.